Early in the morning on the 4th, we hitched up the wagon and headed out to meet our destiny and write our names in the immortal granite of racing history. Little Pete traveled jauntily behind our wagon. There were at least 10 of us traveling together, and about 3 times that many were still back on the roundup grounds awaiting the opportunity to come and see the show. Not all of the people were Mo Beattie's night crowd. A couple of army officers and their wives were spreading blankets on the ground and breaking out baskets of goodies in preparation for a picnic. Colonel Andrew's Mexican boy met us and guided us under the trees to where they'd roped off a little area for us. HB tied Little Pain up, using the rope strung around the trees as a picket line. About 20 yards separated us from the colonel's big tent, and we could see his racing string tied side by side in the shade, eating from the feed bags tied to their heads. Billy strode off to find Colonel Andrews and lay out the race course. Andy and most of our crowd had followed HB over to look at Baby, and Carlita assured me he had things under control. Our Mexican cook was about half bandit, and he patted the pistol and knife at his belt. I figured Little Paint was safe enough. It was still a good 3 hours before the race was to be run, and with time to kill, I wandered my way along the crowd to see who I could see. I ambled my way along, greeting many I didn't know and stopping from time to time to visit with some old acquaintance. I was working my way through the crowd when I saw Long Tom standing there with a smile on his face. He was looking a lot more prosperous than the last time I saw him. A new felt hat, not even broken in yet, sat on top his head. He wore a white shirt tucked into his duck pants held up by suspenders, and a pair of tall-topped boots with long, flapping mule ear tugs.
Looks like the times are changing.
Slowly, slowly.
How's the freighting business?
Better than I'd hoped.
We took us a walk to catch up the other one on what had been happening during the past summer. Seemed like Long had latched onto a good deal. He was then running not one wagon, but 3. He had his original wagon and 3 yoke oxen, and had purchased another large wagon about the same. He had also acquired a smaller wagon with 4 big mules to pull it. The ox rigs could handle about 4,000 pounds of freight apiece, and the mule rig between 2,000 and 3,000.
Sounds like you've been doing real good, real quick.
There's a lot of business, and the money's good, but not that good. I've been busy, and a banker up at Caldwell offered to loan me some money to, what he called, expand my operations.
You're gonna get rich if you ain't careful.
My freighting business ain't all I've been expanding.
There was a cousin of his back in the Chickasaw Nation who, it seems, was equally talented where the making of whiskey was concerned. Long was hauling some government supplies periodically down to Fort Reno, and as of late, he'd been going on down into the Chickasaw Nation to load out corn. The hiding of a few boxes of whiskey and a load of ear corn was a very simple matter. There were a lot of Indians who dearly loved to get a hold of a little of Satan's tonic, and a growing number of cowboys filling the Cherokee Strip and other parts of the territory who approached the stuff with equal enthusiasm. It seemed that Long had the business acumen, the good sense, and the moral depravity to take advantage of such a ready and lucrative market. He was picking up most of his freight out of Kansas and covering a big swath of country. His deliveries covered several of the various forts and Indian agencies in the territory and many ranches in the Texas Panhandle. Now, the trade in whiskey was strictly prohibited in the Indian territory. But oh, that made for a good market. There's nothing like a little illegality to create demand. As I later learned from Long, there were a few rules to operate by when you were peddling whiskey. The first one was to be on the lookout for John Law. The government was hell-bent and set on keeping liquor away from the Indians, and probably just as set on collecting taxes on liquor made and sold to its citizens. A man had to keep on the lookout for tribal light horse, federal deputy marshals, and even the U.S. Army at times. The only thing that stopped a man from peddling a little whiskey in the Indian Territory was the law, and there were too few of its representatives working a whole lot of country. Second, a man always collected his money before the goods were handed over, and you never gave more than a sip for a sample, or you would soon have more friends than you had liquor. Third and last, you never stayed around too long after selling Indians a bunch of whiskey. Given their warlike nature and the fact that to white men they were considerably unpredictable at best, they were liable to get drunk enough to scalp you and take the rest of your makings. Now, some might think that it was prejudicial to suppose that liquor had any worse of an effect on the Indians as a whole than it did on white folks. But it was the truth. I've heard people talk about how we whipped the Indians by killing their buffalo and the army burning out their winter camps. But to my way of thinking, formed by a life in that time and country, we whipped them because we brought three things that the Indians were lacking: smallpox, lawyers, and whiskey. We continued our rounds while Long questioned me thoroughly about Billy, Andy, and myself. I filled them in as best I could, and he was especially curious when I got to the part about our racehorse.
You boys the ones that are going to run against Colonel Andrews' horse?
Yep.
That little old Pinto of Billy's is your racehorse?
Yep.
Is he fast, sure enough?
You ain't the only one that's come into good fortune.
Y'all better watch your money. Do you know this Colonel Andrews?
We've met him.
But you don't know him.
Well, we ain't foolish enough to believe he ain't a professional, if that's what you're asking.
He's sure enough a professional. You better be careful not to bet all you got with that man and expect to win.
How is it that you know him?
I met him coming up the trail a week ago and sold him some whiskey.
And you know all about him now?
No. I was just starting my story and you interrupted.
Well, go ahead then.
I'd already heard about the Colonel a long time back. Seems like your bunch is the only ones that don't know about him.
To hear Long tell it, Colonel Andrews was darn near famous for his sporting ways from the Gulf to Denver. He traveled the roads and trails of the West, dragging a team of racehorses, fighting roosters, a few pit dogs, and even a foot racer from time to time. He was a high-stakes man, and there wasn't anything he wouldn't bet on, and even less that he hadn't won money on.
All I'm going to say is you boys had better be careful with your money.
You don't seem to have a very high opinion of our good senses or our judgment where horses and character are concerned, do you?
I've had more practice than you. White folks like him been skinning me since I was knee-high to a mule. When you're black, you learn that white people don't make any attempt to cover up the fact that their only aim is to get something out of you and no more. It's just natural that over the years I've come to know their look. He's one of those southern boys that don't know nothing about nothing except for riding horses, playing cards, beating blacks, and sipping fancy liquor. He'd shoot you over nothing while he read his paper and talked about the price of cotton, and he wouldn't miss. He was raised in white diapers, and his mama told him he was the best thing since grits. He came naturally to assume he was better than most folks, and he's on the lookout to take advantage of that. All the while, he's smiling at you. He's figuring on just how smart you are, how much he could take you for.
You seem to know a lot about your fellow man.
I ought to. One of those just like him was my daddy.
Well, at least half of you is all right.
Which half?
The half that can make good whiskey.
Long wanted to see Billy and Andy and take a look at our racehorse. I led the way over toward our wagon.
Indians! Indians are coming!
Crowd stampeded over me and liked to have trampled me to death. All eyes were looking to the east, and sure enough, a long line of Cheyennes was pawing over the top of a rise toward our camp. I guarantee you it was some sight to see. They dragging their teepees and travois behind their ponies, and every one of them was decked out in their best outfits. Strung beads and feathers blew in the wind, and the sunshine made the white buckskin a few of them wore all the brighter. There must have been 100 of them, squaws, children, warriors, all of them. Their camp moved to some age-old migratory rhythm set to the time of their ponies' shuffling hooves and creak of travois poles. The braves, half-naked and armed to the damn teeth, rode at the perimeter of the tribe for security. A good-sized herd of grass-slick horses was driven alongside the line of their march by a gang of rowdy boys. And wouldn't you know it, Old Chief Blue Knife was riding at the head of the procession. And nobody knew if Blue Knife came to burn us out or shake our hands. In his younger day, he was known to be a temperamental sort, just as apt to befriend you as he was to cut your heart out and feed it to the dogs. Well, just when you think things can't get any worse is just when they are bound to. Long poked me in the ribs with his foot to get my attention, and then he pulled me up to my feet.
One more thing I forgot to tell you. You remember old Harvey? He was the man you traded those Cheyenne horses to.
Yeah.
He and the colonel are brothers. Saw him this morning.
Who?
Harvey.
He's here?
He is. And he was looking for Billy and some other boys with a paint racehorse. Seems he had a near miss with some Cheyenne who caught him with stolen horses.
The Cheyenne uprising was put down before it even began. Chief Blue Knife stopped his bunch about 40 yards out from us. He sat his horse patiently, and he didn't have long to wait. Cap Barrington stepped from the crowd and walked out to talk to him. It seemed that the good people of the newly formed Wheeler County had elected the ranger as their first sheriff. The captain jawed a while with the old chief and then came back and had a conference with the military officers. When that was over, he marched right back out to Blue Knife and they talked some more. I couldn't make out what they were saying, but it must have been something agreeable to Cap because he didn't shoot anybody. Blue Knife turned his pony around and rode back to powwow with some of his warriors. After a meeting of the Aboriginal mines, the whole band of Indians started off again, angling for a point farther upstream. Everyone continued to watch the Cheyenne almost hypnotically while they paraded by. The Indians stopped and started pitching camp on the north bank of the Sweetwater, about 150 yards upstream from the race grounds. Like most of the Plains tribes, the Cheyenne loved gambling, especially horse racing, and they had their share of those who lusted for the bottle just like we did. To everybody's surprise, and before too long, Indians were mixing in and out of the camp, and everyone settled back down to the fun at hand. The Cheyenne brought along a few swift horses themselves, and before long, the number of scheduled horse races grew. Long and I made our way back to the chuck wagon and found Billy and the rest of our gang already preparing for the race.
How are you, General?
About to be rich and famous.
Billy had put up 200 of his bet with the colonel, and the rest of us chipped in to make the other half. The rumor was flying around there that there was $10,000 cash in the colonel's tent. Now, that sounded pretty steep, but I guarantee you a pile was bet that day, and not just with the Mobeety bookies. Many citizens made their own bets with each other, and nobody knew just how deep the Cheyenne were bailing in. There wasn't much time for socializing because Billy and Andy were furiously working on a saddle there to quad. The colonel had a special lightweight racing saddle. Since we lacked one ourselves, Billy had purchased an old cavalry McClellan to avoid the weight disadvantage one of our heavy stock saddles would have caused. Before we knew it, the race was ready to start. We left Andy and Carlito to take care of our horse and made our way down to the start line. Stakes with red painted tops had been driven into the ground to mark the race course. They ran in a dead line away from the creek across the flat for long, long ways and turned in a big loop and arced their way back to finish where they had begun. There were three Cheyenne horses entered and their jockeys rode up to the scratch mark bareback and half naked. Bill Thompson had a black horse entered and he joined the Cheyenne Buffalo runners at the line. The crowd parted to admit the last entry. It was one of the colonel's horses that we had not seen before, and he stuck out like a sore thumb. He was another thoroughbred for sure, although he wasn't the looker that the big gelding we had seen a few nights before had been. The colonel's little old Mexican boy was riding a funny little saddle set way forward on the horse's withers. Cap Arrington was to stop the race, and he stood atop a wagon at the start-finish line. He stood grim-faced with his pistol pointing at the sky like he was threatening God Almighty himself. Well, the horses were bunched for a while, but soon lined out head to tail in a tight line, with one of the Cheyenne horses leading. The colonel's thoroughbred was last, but his rider looked to be holding him in check. They raced away into the distance and then were rounding that far turn. The same Cheyenne horse held the lead, but the colonel's horse had moved to second by the time they came out of the turn and started the long straight stretch back to the finish line. 300 yards away and it was a two-horse race. The Cheyenne horse and the thoroughbred ran neck to neck and so close you couldn't walk between them. When they came across the line, it was the colonel's horse a winner by two lengths. Well, the Mexican boy made his way back toward their camp and he was followed by the Cheyenne who'd come in second. I was returning to our campsite and so got to see the Cheyenne dismount in front of where the colonel stood at his tent. Solemnly, the brave handed the reins of his lathered horse to the colonel and walked away. The colonel looked over his pride with several of his friends while the dejected Cheyenne trudged back to his people. Well, you can't keep a good man down, and seeing Little Paint being shined up and ready for his race drove all doubts from my mind. When I walked up, Andy was putting on a new bright red shirt with a large C embroidered on the back of it in white. The second race was about to start, but we were too busy running into each other while we frantically went about searching for something to do to get ready to race. The only calm one in the bunch was Billy. He was wearing a new white shirt and a green neckerchief with white polka dots, and he leaned against a tree with the sole of one boot propped back against the trunk and calmly smoked a cigarette down to the butt in 10 seconds. Being of a cautious nature and overly wise for my age, I hadn't bet a single damn dime on the race other than the $20 required for my part of the $200 Billy hadn't had to bet. I'd only parted with that money out of loyalty to a friend short of funds rather than giving in to the gambling urge like the rest of those boys. Billy untied Little Paint and led him out into the open. Andy started to mount, but HB stopped him.
Get those spurs off. They're too heavy.
Andy quickly shed them and started once again to mount, but he stopped himself this time. He dug into his pockets and pulled out a handful of small change in his pocket knife. Then he pulled off his belt and he took his tobacco makings out of his shirt pocket.
Here, Tennessee, hold these for me. I need to lighten up.
We watched while he walked the horse out into a big circle and brought him back again. Little Paint seemed to be feeling good and traveling fine. Andy continued to walk him around while we waited. Soon, the people down at the start line parted and made a long alley of bodies opening up to the race cars. That was our signal. We started in their direction. Several of the cowboys off Roundup walked with us. As we passed the colonel's tent, the Mexican jockey came out on Baby and pulled in alongside of Andy and Little Paint. If something had happened and the race had never been run that day, it still would have been something to see those two horses together in one place. Baby looked like a queen, with her neck arched proudly against the bit, her little nostrils flaring in her muzzle, and her feet moving over the ground like snowflakes in the summer. Little Paint might not have been as professionally outfitted in raised colors and shiny tack, but he knew that he was the man on that afternoon. He wasn't pretty as Baby, but he was ready and raring to go. As we walked, I kept my eye on the people lining each side of our path. When we came to the track, I saw the colonel waiting, and Harvey stood at his side. He didn't say a thing as we walked past, but I noticed Billy kept his hand near his pistol until we'd reached the far side of the finish line. The course Billy and the colonel had agreed upon was 375 yards of the first straightaway that the earlier races had been run upon. They'd taken a team of horses and a homemade drag made out of a large iron cauldron turned upside down and knocked the top off the grass for the length of 375 yards. Everyone had chipped in and walked over the track, removing the larger rocks and grass clumps and clods. Two poles had been cut and placed in the ground on either side of the track at the far end. The horses were to start there and race back to the line the other horses had been starting from. They'd moved Cap Arrington's wagon down to the far end, but he stepped out in the middle of the track.
Everyone quiet down! Ladies and gentlemen, you're about to witness a match race at 375 yards between Colonel Andrews' Baby and Billy Champion's War Bonnet.
I turned to Billy in confusion.
What the hell?
Billy looked equally as confused. The jockeys walked the two horses around Cap, and as Andy came by, we tried to motion him over to see if he knew what was going on. He grinned sheepishly.
They asked me earlier what we called our horse, and I couldn't help it. War Bonnet sounded better.
So that's how the famous race between Baby and War Bonnet came about. When folks talk about that race years later and they mention War Bonnet, they have the imagination of an ignoramus kid to thank for it. But I have to admit it did sound better.
I will judge a fair start and sound the gun when both parties answer at the mark. Scratches and false starts will be called back and we will restart. Please keep back from the course and give them room at the finish line. I'll personally shoot anyone who gets in their way.
Our bunch stood on the far side of the finish line opposite of the colonel and his gang, while two boys stretched a long length of ribbon across the finish line, the colonel raised the glass he held up to us in salute. Billy returned the gesture with the tip of his hat. We all waited expectantly as the two horses lined up. Finally, Andy and the Mexican started both horses side by side at the walk and approached the scratch line at the same time. It worked, and they paused a split second. That race was one of the most glorious things I have ever seen, and a sprint race doesn't last but a few seconds. Both those horses shot out of the hole and ran nose to nose and necks outstretched, bellies down, and tails flying. They came to the finish line, and for a minute I thought we was beat. Baby looked to have a nose on us, but in the last instant, 30 yards out, Little Paint, or War Bonnet, if you will, seemed to drop even lower and gather more speed. And when they came across the line, it was War Bonnet by nose. Andy came back with our horse and bailed off right into our midst while Carlito took the bridle. H.B. waved his arms frantically for us to quiet down.
Hells bells, boys. You don't understand when I say we're loaded. I took the money Warren gave me to make payroll for the summer, and I bet her all.
Billy grabbed up old Hell's bells and lifted them plumb off the ground. Some of us were already heading out to collect our bets, and I was left standing alone for a moment in the middle of the track. A big Cheyenne came walking right up to me, and it was Blue Knife.
That's a fast horse.
I did not know what to say. In fact, I just stood there like I was shocked.
You picked a strong Cheyenne pony. Won me lots of money.
That Indian's face cracked into a big smile, and he turned and walked away. I never said a thing. I just watched him leave with my mouth hanging open. It took me a moment to even untrack one step. I'd taken about two of those shaky steps when Andy came running toward me.
Hey! Dutch Henry and the boys have robbed the stakeholders and got off with all our money.
Ours was a rags-to-riches story, and in the manner of the turbulent fortunes of the high-stakes gambling world, we didn't have long to enjoy our fortune before we went back in rags. We never even got one sniff of our winnings before some damn highwayman held up the guards and took off with our stakes. Once the robbery was confirmed, somebody gathered up the guards, shook them a time or two to get the straight of things, and in a matter of moments, almost every man in camp was ready to go kill something. Cap Arrington took a stand before us.
I'll shoot the son of a bitch who messes up the sign left by these bandits.
We gathered in a rough semicircle before him to listen.
They're just getting farther away while we sit around here and jaw.
I've already put scouts on the trail.
Billy was sitting his horse beside me.
This is about the most sorry-ass looking posse I ever seen.
Looking around me, I had to agree with him. A lot of the cowboys and more than a few others had bet their saddles and pistols on the race. It seemed the Dutch's boys had taken all the shooters with the rest of the loot. And to top things off, they ran a rope through the swells of every saddle held in the stakes and drugged the whole pile of hulls across the prairie while they fled. As a result, half of the boys in the posse were barebacked and unarmed.
Oh, Cheyenne don't look anywhere near as ridiculous riding bareback.
That's because folks that ride bareback all the time just naturally know not to pick a raw-backed horse.
Well, bandits are definitely a bold, sassy bunch to pull this off.
From what I've heard about Dutch Henry, he's got balls as big as church bells.
Now, man, Dutch Henry's retired. We're just going after some outlaws of the average sort.
Well, it seemed that most of our group preferred the thought of being robbed by such a notorious character as Dutch Henry instead of any old run-of-the-mill bandits.
Cap's right. I know for a fact that the law caught old Dutch and hauled him to Dodge City.
Wait, is he in prison?
Hell no. Dutch is wily enough to know you won't get far in the outlaw business without the best lawyers money can buy.
If he ain't in prison, where's he at?
He's moved on to other parts. This damned country is getting too civilized for an outlaw to operate with the proper aplomb and bold manner which he was accustomed to.
You men pay heed to me and we'll catch these robbers. Just remember, don't go shooting these bandits if you can help it. Let the law deal with them.
Cap loped off toward the Sweetwater with all of us at his heels and threatening to run him down. We followed a line of torn up ground where the outlaws had drugged the saddles.
A couple of the Cheyenne scouts were waiting for us on the bank of the Sweetwater about 4 miles down the creek. They had found where the outlaws had crossed, and figuring a bunch of dumb white men couldn't track an elephant through a snowbank, a few of them were waiting to guide us. The trail led straight west, mile after mile, and hour after hour. And every time our horses' hooves hit the ground, somebody was either propping themselves up off a galded crotch or reaching for the comfort of a pistol that wasn't there anymore. And with each and every step of the way, they got madder. And the thoughts of many in our posse dwelled on the tortuous manner with which they would deal with the bandits once they captured them. It was more than justice that we demanded. It was revenge. Yeah, it was gonna be a short trial, a quick verdict, and those money-stealing, ass-torturing, emasculating sons of bitches were gonna hang if we could catch them. The afternoon of the second day, the trail split between the headwaters of McClellan Creek and the Mulberry. The Cheyenne scout determined that there were 5 men in the outlaw gang. 3 of the men had headed northwest toward the Canadian, while the other 2 had turned off to the southwest. A quick powwow was held, and it seemed that Arrington had received the Army's assurance that they would proceed at haste westward up the Canadian, looking to cut the sign of the outlaw gang. Riders had also been sent to Tascosa to notify authorities in that locality of the possibility of our bandits passing through in the near future. It appeared that the 3 outlaws who had turned north were riding into our support, while the 2 who'd ridden away from the Canadian had the greatest chance for escape. Arrington quickly divided our posse. 1 group, led by Colonel Andrews, was to pursue the 3 outlaws headed for the Canadian as closely as possible and strengthen their number by rendezvous with the soldiers, if feasible. The Cheyenne went with the Colonel, as they claimed the country to the southwest had always been bad medicine for them, fit for nothing but Comanches and Mexicans. Meanwhile, Cap would lead the other party in pursuit of the 2 outlaws who'd headed southwest. All of our Lazy F crowd, including myself, went with Cap at his request because of our supposed knowledge of the country where we were headed. We lost the trail several miles down the Mulberry, but we continued on, looking to pick it back up. Our way led down the creek to where the J.A. boys were building a set of pens on the flats there. A crew was digging post holes, and a wide, stocky man with a set of white whiskers put down his crowbar and walked out to meet us. Even after Cap informed him of our mission to apprehend the outlaws, the man continued to eye us with more than a little disdain. Upon hearing Cap out with only a few interruptions of profanity, he tugged at his whiskers some and called one of his hands over. Upon questioning, the hand told us that 2 horsemen had come up by the camp that morning and stopped to eat. They had tried to trade horses, but the J.A. hands had suspected what they were and sent them on their way astride the horses they came in on.
Which way were they headed?
Where in the hell do you think?
Colonel, when I catch him, I might ask him where they were headed.
Texas seemed to have a colonel or a captain behind every bush, and I began to feel a little left out. I began considering a title for myself. This was my first acquaintance with Colonel Charles Goodnight, and despite the fact that I was never to know him well, I got the impression that he was a man who felt great impatience with the portion of the world outside his operation.
It sure as hell didn't go up my canyon, so they'll have to ride up the Tule. At the head of the Tule, the old Comanchero Trail forks 3 ways. They could go west to Las Escarbadas, northwest to the head of the Trujillo, and Puerto de los Vejenos, or southwest across Double Mountain Fork to the Yellow Houses. You should split your men and send 1 bunch up the Paladuro and across to the Trujillo. The other bunch can ride like hell to Las Escarbadas. You ought to be able to head them off or catch up to them.
And what if they go south?
Well, then, you can chase them some more, but it's been my experience that most bandits are headed for Fort Sumner or Las Vegas. And your average bandit is just smart enough to know he needs to go west and not south to get to either one.
I came through that country. It didn't go just like you tell it.
Yeah, and you'd like to have killed yourself, too. Not many men have any sense of direction or the skill necessary to navigate such a country beyond the bounds of its known trails. And I doubt your bandits are any exception.
Well, we bid you a good day, Colonel, and leave you to the romantic undertaking of building an empire.
Good night squinted in the sun and gave Cap a look that would have soured corn on the stalk.
Farrington, saddle up and go with these horse racers and catch the bandits for them.
To hell with you, Colonel. I'm perfectly capable of catching my own bandits.
Well, go on then. You're impeding my progress in this construction.
Come on, let's get out of here.
I rode off thinking that he must have thought a lot of the man he was sending, or else he didn't think much of us. But for some reason, I decided I liked that cantankerous devil. Well, the bandits did flee up the Tule, and then west to Las Escarbadas, just like Goodnight predicted. For years, I'd heard about Las Escarbadas, or the Scrapings. But there wasn't much to them except for the water seeping into several pits dug in a desolate draw. The West was full of romantic-sounding place names and made you want to get up and travel. And when you got to where you were going, well, you usually found that the only thing significant about the location was its ability to keep you from dying of thirst, or that the finding of it let you know that you weren't entirely lost. We never came into sight of them that day, but at daybreak the next morning, we spotted smoke coming up out of a wide, shallow draw to the north. We were a good 4 miles off when we spotted the smoke, but we smelled the sheep at about the same time. The bandits' tracks led straight toward the smoke. It seemed that even a sheep herder's camp in the middle of nowhere was prone to visitors. When we had neared to within a quarter of a mile, Cap had to dismount and walk. Just back from the lip of the draw, a couple of the men took the horses' reins while the rest of us began bellying up to the point where the ground fell away so as to avoid skylining ourselves. And you can be sure the ground over which we crawled was 8 feet short and covered with sheep droppings. Thinking our bandits had seen us and that we were under fire, Cap rose to his feet and waved us forward with the barrel of his gun.
Hey, come on, boys!
We made our way the last few yards up the rise and then skipped to a halt. Below us, about 400 yards away, was a wagon and a camp surrounded by sheep. The outlaws' 2 hip-shot, worn-out horses stood teetering off to one side. And what looked like one dead man lay by the campfire, still in his blankets. An outlaw with a pistol in his hand stood over the dead man. Despite the fact that less than half of us had rifles, we all opened fire. The outlaws were obviously professional, as they did not waste time turning fire with their shotguns, but instead raced for the sheep herder's team of wagon horses staked nearby.
Bring up the horses!
The handlers were having a hard time leading the horses because of all the ruckus.
Cease fire! Mount up!
All but Billy started for the horses, and he remained kneeling on the ground with his shots to his shoulders. Billy continued to hold his aim. Billy managed to down one of the outlaws' horses. We charged down the slope toward the camp. I managed to be near the lead, but held my fire. Most of the other men did not. The sheep raced furiously, and the bandit still on horseback had hell getting through the woolies. The other bandit and his downed horse were lost in the stir of wool and dust.
Just as we raced past the camp and veered around the edge of the herd in pursuit of the mounted outlaw, I caught a glimpse of a man standing beside a dead horse in the middle of the sheep. I pulled my horse up and somehow managed to get down off him with my Winchester still in my hand. Visibility was poor due to the dust, and the bandit in the herd was no longer in sight by the time I was ready to shoot. That sheep had hit me in the back of the knee. I flopped myself around in the dust and fought to aim my rifle from a prone position. I was too close to the sheep, and down low like I was, I couldn't make anything out. Despite the fact that I had no clear target, I rose to my knees. While I held my fire, several of the posse rode back and dismounted around me. I don't know if they could see any better than me or just shooting to be shooting. Andy came tearing up to me astride a lathered horse.
Are you hit, Tennessee?
I'm all right, but you better get down from that horse.
Realizing that he was the tallest target in the neighborhood right then, Andy scrambled down out of the saddle and took a post beside me.
Don't worry, I won't let him take us.
You couldn't hit that herd of sheep from here.
I can too, damn it, I already hit one.
As proof, Andy pointed out one of the animals on the edge of the herd that was humped up with blood slowly staining the wool of its side.
Yeah, well, you weren't trying to hit the sheep, were you?
They already got the other bandit!
Who did?
He and the captain shot at each other on the run until they were both empty. And then Dale Martin ran him down and roped him.
Is he still alive?
They drug a little hide off, bringing him back.
I'm shot to pieces. If you boys will quit shooting, I'll come out.
Come ahead.
Well, that bandit managed to limp out of the sheep in pretty good fashion for a man shot to pieces. He'd thrown down his gun, and our men tied him up with a catch rope in no time. Captain Dale Martin was leading the other bandit at the end of a rope behind him. The two criminals were reunited, and we all made our way back to the campsite. I was one of the last to arrive on account of that Andy had to go catch my horse for me. When we got to camp, we found that every single man in our crowd had stopped to gather around the campfire in silence. Billy was standing next to the captain at the center of the circle the men had formed.
What the hell's the matter?
He never even answered me. He just pointed a finger at where everybody else was staring. I looked down in that direction, and I saw the murdered sheep herder's body beside the fire. The blankets were disarrayed and did little to cover the condition of the corpse.
Well, I'll be damned.
There wasn't just one body in the blanket, but two. And they were naked as the day they were born. It wasn't the nakedness that had everyone silent, though, but their positions in relation to each other.
Those two must have been really close friends.
You don't reckon they were shot and just landed that way, do you?
The bottom body was face down, with the other laid atop it in a similar fashion. It didn't take me long at all to have seen more than enough.
You don't reckon they're still attached, do you?
Oh, damn, Andy.
The prisoners were seated on the wagon tongue with a guard watching over them. The interrogation was a little slow coming, as most of us were still wearing confused looks on our faces, and our attention was half diverted. Cap came forward and stopped before the two prisoners. Neither of them would look him in the eye. I didn't recognize either one of them, but I hadn't been in the country long either. It seemed that most of our crowd knew one of them. He was a clean-cut young man dressed like a cowboy. He was fair-haired and couldn't have been much out of his teens. The other man was a grimy sort you could see in the last remaining dregs of the buffalo hunters hanging around Mobeety or Fort Griffin.
Where's the money at?
What we got left of it's in our saddlebags.
Somebody had already caught up the bandit's original horses, and the saddlebags on each were soon removed and brought before Cap. He continued to eye the prisoners while a couple of the boys dug around in the saddlebags.
A rough count was made of the contents, and only about $300 was found, there being only two small bags of corn and one bundle of paperbacks.
I told you we only had our cut of it.
I'm figuring that what you stole split five ways comes up to a hell of a lot more than what you've got here.
Well, we were robbed.
Oh, he's robbed. He's robbed.
I'm telling the truth. I swear it.
I bet they figured we were close and buried it somewhere along the way.
He's telling the truth.
Who robbed you?
We got robbed on our cut.
You split the loot on McClellan Creek?
Yeah. That damn...
You keep quiet, Lem. Do you hear me?
You better talk, Hughes. You're in a pinch here.
To hell with you. I'll kill him if he can't keep his mouth shut.
You ain't gonna kill anybody, because we're gonna hang you.
I'm not scared of dying.
That's good, son.
Don't any of you boys have a smoke, do you?
Who'd you split the money with, Lem?
Well, give me a smoke and I'll talk. Maybe you'll catch him and hang him later.
Someone pushed a lit cigarette into his whiskers.
It was Harvey Andrews. His brother put us onto the job and Harvey led it.
You mean Colonel Andrews was in on the take?
Hell yes. We were to split the loot in Las Vegas. And Harvey would take his brother's share to him later. We got worried about who was behind us and stopped to split our shares on the McClellan.
You loose-mouthed bastard. If I had a gun, I'd kill you.
Cake, you spend too much time reading those penny dreadfuls. There's no such thing as honor among thieves.
Later, I learned that the kid's name was Cake Hughes. He was the son of some English dude with a handful of titles who had sent him out west to learn the cattle trade. Cake had earned his name when several of the men he was working with had discovered that he was hiding something from them that he had received in his Christmas mail. Not long after, he was caught out behind a shed eating fruitcake out of a box his mother had sent him. Well, it seemed that Cake Hughes had been working around our neck of the woods for about 2 years. And in all that time, the only thing anybody remembered about him was that he spent a lot of his spare time reading about outlaws and the rest of it practicing with his pistol. From what I heard, his daddy must have given him quite a stipend, because he used up about $400 worth of ammunition shooting into a dirt bank out back of his line cabin his first winter in the panhandle.
Before I could count my share, Harvey, Mexican Joe, and Handles McElroy, they threw down on us, told us to get packing in another direction.
I thought the Comanches killed Handles years ago on the Pecos.
Nah, but he does have less hair than he did back then.
They scalped him?
Yeah. Cut off his ears, too. He's been meaner than a shedding rattler ever since.
He was mean enough before. Who's Mexican Joe?
Just another Mexican outlaw, as far as I know. I guess that country's so full of thieves, they have to come north to find work.
Cap pulled out a little tally book and the stub of a pencil. He wrote the names of the alleged gang inside. Either his memory must have been poor, or he was planning on writing a book in his retirement years. Once that was done, he turned his attention to the kid.
Cake, what have you got to say about that deal over yonder?
They were queers.
That don't explain why you had to sneak up on them and shoot them.
They were too busy rutting to have to be snuck up on.
Did you do the killing or the both of you?
Him. He was too worried about being followed.
And all you could think about was killing. Is that right?
Hell, they were just sheepherders. And queer ones at that.
Get up!
Some of Cake's bravado left him, and he failed to meet Cap's hard gaze.
What are you aiming to do?
You're gonna dig a hole, boy. You're gonna dig it deep and proper so we can bury those men. I aim to work some of that meanness out of you.
Somebody went out and found a shovel in the wagon. Another man untied his wrists and stuck the tool in his hands.
What about them?
He's gonna help.
But I didn't shoot nobody.
No, but I guess you were a well-wisher to it.
Lem was untied, and both of them were marched over to a spot of ground near the bodies. Cap took the heel of his boot and began to mark out the dimensions of a grave. Once he was finished, he gestured for the prisoners to get to work. There was only one shovel, but a large tin can was rounded up and given to the pair for another digging instrument.
I want it dug deep.
It will take me all day to dig two graves in this ground. It's hard enough to wear out a dozen shovels.
I guess one grave extra big old work. I don't think they'd mind.
Late in the afternoon, Lem threw his can up out of the hole and rested his hands on his hips.
Well, boys, she's finished. I reckon I just about dug myself to hell.
Lem came up out of the grave almost reluctantly, and Kid crawled out with a lot less piss and vinegar than he'd started with. We just folded the bodies of the sheep herders up in the blanket they lay on and set them down in the grave.
Anybody want to say any words?
H.B. finally stepped forward.
I guess I will. I knew them. Not well, but I knew them.
We all put our hats in our hands despite the sun and stared down into the hole.
Their names were Barry and McGurty, and they weren't always sheep herders. When I knew them, they were freighting in whiskey south of Dome's Crossing and trading a little with the Indians north of the river. I sure don't know what caused them to lose all their morals since then. Lord, I don't know much else to say, but please have mercy on these sodomites, because I don't think they were always such. And Lord, let this be a lesson to the boys here to avoid herding sheep, because once a man starts living like that, it's just a long slide to the bottom. Amen.
Amen. Amen.
Our prisoners began shoveling again. I stepped off with Billy to chew the fat a while.
You once told me you spent time in a church. You reckon God hates their kind?
No, I don't think he hates them. He wouldn't like their ways, but then again, a lot of us are paddling that canoe.
Billy didn't answer, and I could tell he was turning it around in his mind some.
My mother always told me that God loves us all, and that we're all sinners.
You think they could go to heaven?
I don't know just how much God would hold their being queer against them.
No, that ain't what I'm talking about at all. You think that God would let a sheep herder into heaven?
About that time, Andy walked up, and I could see Billy measuring him for what was about to come out of the boy's mouth.
I grew up with an old boy like that back home. We always figured he was a little off. You know, he talked kind of sissy-like and didn't like the way us boys played sometimes. Turns out, later, that he ran off with some drummer, and his daddy caught them down the road a piece in a hotel. He shot them both and rode home and had breakfast like nothing had happened. His wife asked him what went on, and he told her straight out. He said he loved his son too much to see him carrying on that way.
Damn, that's rough.
His daddy wasn't like that, or none of his kin. His daddy sired 8 kids and his grandpa about that many. His mama said the drummer took advantage of his youth. We all knew he was a little bit girly. Other than that, he was all right. Hell, we used to shoot bean flips and throw pocket knives and go skinny dipping down behind the schoolhouse just to make the girls giggle and run home.
You swam naked with them?
There was several of us boys swimming.
There's a whole bunch of you?
Well, yeah. I mean, you see, there was...
Did you feel him looking at you?
Oh, he acted all right.
Oh, I don't know, Andy. You might ought to be careful.
Why's that?
Oh, well, it's nothing at all. It's just that, something like that could rub off on you.
Nothing got rubbed off on me!
Oh, I believe you, partner. I was just worried that your friend might have thought you liked swimming with him.
Billy made a show of walking off while stealing doubtful glances back Andy's way. Andy was ready to pull his gun. We followed Billy back to camp. It didn't take Lem and Keg near as long to fill in the grave as it did for them to dig it.
All right, let's break camp.
We drew straws for who had to drive that stinking sheep wagon. Luckily, I drew a long one and only had to help hitch the team. When everything was ready, Cap rode over to where the prisoners were sitting atop the new mound of fresh earth. They both looked up from spelling themselves when Cap pitched his rope down on the ground before him.
My father wouldn't hear of this.
You're a long way from home, son, and he probably won't hear of it at all.
You can't hang me here.
No, son. We're going to ride west till we find a suitable tree, and then we're going to hang you.
We found a grove of big cottonwoods along a dry branch less than a half day's ride east of Fort Sumner. We didn't even unhitch the team or loosen our cinches. Without a word from Cap, Martin led the prisoners into the trees.
We need another horse.
Nobody wanted to volunteer their mount. I guess none of us liked the thought of a man being hanged from the back of our horse. Cap didn't volunteer his either, but remained on its back while we all stood around on foot. I guess it wouldn't have looked right for him to preside over an execution from the ground. HB, being of mature years and possibly more used to such occasions, brought his horse forward by the bridle.
Get on the horse, Cake.
You ain't hanging me. Give me a gun and I'll fight the lot of you. My father's rich. You just let me go and he'll make it right.
Get on that horse.
I guess when the kid met Cap's hard gaze, he knew it was over. And he just died right then and there. He climbed right up on the horse and his hands were tied behind his back. Two catch ropes were thrown over two big limbs on the same side of the tree. The prisoners were led under them, and the horses stood nose to tail, facing opposite each other. We gathered around while Cap and two of the boys placed the loops over the bandits' necks.
You got anything to say?
Don't tell my father what happened to me. Bury my belongings here with me and let him think what he will. What he can imagine is bound to be better than the truth.
What about you, Lem?
I shot buffalo when there were so many, you couldn't see where they began or ended. I found water where there wasn't any, and the worst of it was plenty good. I remember when it was nigh a week's travel to the settlements, and the Indians were thick as flies and bound to take your hair. I came to this country in 67, saw her while she was still fairly new. I remember when the sight of any kind of white woman was rare. Not even that could keep a man from going back out into this forsaken country.
I never thought it would come to this.
I've killed and robbed and whored and cheated my whole life. I reckon hanging's an even swap for just getting to live as long as I have.
Are you through?
Hell yes, I'm through.
I saw one little tear trickle from the corner of Lem's eye, but he kept his chin up and he stared straight ahead. Cap motioned Billy and I away. We both eased off lest the horses try to follow. I was scared to death the horse I held wasn't going to stand still. Cap cracked one horse on the hip with his hat and then doubled back across himself and hit the other.
You want to keep that picture in your head so that it'll never be an easy thing.
It's a hell of a thing, Cap.
We rode out of there to walk, and not a single man looked back. Billy and I rode alongside Cap.
That was quite a shot you made yesterday.
Oh, even a blind hog will find an acorn now and again.
Uh-huh. What part of the country did you say you hailed from?
I didn't.
I sure think I ought to know you.
We had only recovered a little of our fortunes and were anxious to head east and find out the whereabouts of the other posse. Despite our hurry, we took the time to ride into Fort Sumner for resupply and so Cap could leave word of the abandoned sheep at Pete Maxwell's trading post. The old fort was in fact a fort no longer, the military having left and sold everything years before. Maxwell's Enterprise now occupied the former post. It was a low-slung affair of several adobe buildings forming a rough plaza of sorts, surrounded by the settlement that had grown around it over the years. The residents were more than a little suspicious-looking. A horde of tough-looking characters standing around and eyeing us with no love at all. Our posse was under constant observation from the minute we arrived. Cap went to Maxwell's big house down by the river to palaver, while the rest of us stood around under the shaded veranda of the old barracks and smacked our lips over a jug of tequila. None of us were especially fond of the sticky concoction, but it was the cheapest thing available. I watched the scattering of Mexicans working for Maxwell going about their business timidly, making sure not to hang around too long or look anybody in the eye. They obviously saw trouble in the making and they wanted no part of it. Our lust for revenge was slowly being dampened by other concerns. Most of our posse consisted of men who should have still been with the roundup. Every one of us was probably returning east to be fired for leaving the herd because none of us were on the payroll for racing horses and chasing outlaws, and HB had the loss of Weirin's payroll to think about. Cap soon returned, and we made ready for the long ride back to Mobebe. We left the wagon and team with Maxwell and rode out with a puny sack of victuals to feed us and a bait of corn for the horses. Our entire posse was thus equipped to travel over 100 miles.
Here's a little something to fortify the inner man.
Billy held a fresh bottle of cactus juice aloft for all of us to see.
You just got one?
I'd have gotten more, but Cap's a stickler for discipline.
Well, I've been worse supplied. All a man needs to travel in wild country is a few cartridges to shoot some game, a little salt to cook your meat, and some whiskey to shorten the miles.
Well, what about a good sense of direction? They say Goodnight can find water out here when nobody else can. And he's never been lost.
Water, you say? I never touched the stuff. Fish, screw in it. You and Goodnight can have your sense of direction, and I'll take the whiskey. I remember when that know-it-all old windbag was wandering his ass all around this country, ranging after Comanches, and didn't have a clue where he was most of the time. Just because he's finally learned this country doesn't mean he's a homing pigeon or something. In my opinion, knowing where you are all the time is just damned unrealistic.